Welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast, a podcast incorporating narratives about facing and navigating adversity, a mixture of people, their experiences, and professional psychological discussion. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn-Tirillo. I'm a qualified and regulated psychologist with over 20 years' experience of mental health, disability, and human behaviour. I want to share people's stories of navigating adversity in the hope that through being heard, a dose of compassion and some understanding, we can help others in the face of adversity too. Hi, and welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. This is the first episode that I've recorded in 6 months. So I took a little break last year, had a lot of other stuff on and things on at home. So who better to have as my first guest than Mark Randall? I'm going to let you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are and what's brought you on today. Why come on?
Okay, well, I mean, my career started about 46 years ago. So now it might be 47 years ago now. So I started policing, walking the streets as police officers used to do 47 years ago. And always wanted to be a police officer. But I started being a regular police officer. And I soon found out that perhaps the more informal kind of policing appealed to me. So I started doing a lot more covert policing work, sort of undercover kind of operations. And that took me really through most of my career and gradually got promoted a couple of times. And I retired after 30 years as a detective inspector on special branch. And then, because I'd always had a passion for animals, I had an opportunity to start working with animals and kind of using some of the skills that I'd learned in policing to be able to care for animals. So lovely, I could combine my passion with what skills I had. And that was now, 15 years ago. So I've been looking after animal welfare around the world ever since.
And what does that look like? So some of my people follow what I do. So we know each other, don't we, from APDOG, which is the Parliamentary Dog Welfare Group. We've met a couple of conferences and things as well. So some of my listeners already know about that side of my job, but some don't. So when you kind of talk about helping animals and animal welfare, tell us a little bit more about what that looks like for someone who may be totally new to this area and hopefully wants to get involved.
Well, I mean, when I came out of policing, I looked at crimes particularly that were being committed against animals. So it could be, I mean, there's never such thing as a minor crime, but it could be that an animal's welfare needs are not met, or it could be more a darker, more deliberate kind of cruelty.
Yeah.
And that's probably the area that I most linked up with because of the work that I'd done. So I was looking at individuals who were targeting animals, but actually could have been targeting people.
Yes.
So it could be something from sort of dog fighting to animals involved in domestic abuse to animal trafficking, the same as human trafficking. So all of these kind of darker sides of animal welfare issue was really what drew my attention from the background that I had.
And that's the thing that really interests me. So I first came across your work at one of the parliamentary meetings, is that link between human and animal abuse. So we will say for listeners, this is more of a heavy episode, but all of my episodes are listed as explicit because some of the topics that I cover are quite heavy. And that's exactly what I want to cover, is that kind of human animal abuse link. And you do some work for Nature Watch, don't you? Is it all right to tell us a little bit about what Nature Watch are and what they focus on and how you've kind of brought your experience into that work?
The Nature Watch Foundation was formed just over 30 years ago now, and it's sort of multidisciplinary small charity, animal charity, really with the basis of advancing animal welfare across a wide spectrum.
Yeah.
And I've been doing some work in Greece and Ukraine. Ukraine was one of the campaigns that Nature Watch had been focused on for over 30 years. I thought, you know, I could probably reach some of the Ukrainian professionals to start talking to them about animal welfare. So that came about actually after I've been doing some work with Mark Abraham on Lucy's Law, and that's how I came into Nature Watch. So we had this sort of odd conversation. I said, yeah, I'll go to Ukraine and start doing some work. So I started doing that, and really what I was doing was I was aiming at professionals, so particularly politicians and police officers, and showing them with their existing strategies on human safety, how if they started to take animal welfare seriously, they could actually tackle some of their human issues. So it could be child abuse or homicide or domestic abuse, because that way I could actually get animal welfare on the agenda without it being created, seen as extra work. And it resonated in Ukraine, and then I took it to other countries as well.
Which is incredible. I always think you underplay what you do, because we've talked many times, haven't we, about what you do, and I'm always in awe, because essentially what you're doing is supporting animals and helping them move away from mistreatment, but it's the impact on the humans. And this is the stuff that I'm going to say this, it's one of those things that you would think everybody would know, right? That it's really obvious that if somebody is abusing an animal, that there would be a likelihood that they would also behave the same way towards humans. But it's not until you really hear it, or I've been to some AppDog meetings and there's evidence in front of me, that you kind of have this light bulb moment of, if we invested more time and energy and understanding into the animal abuse, we could make a massive shift in things like domestic violence, for example. And I think, kind of say hats off to you, that work is incredible. So when vets are treating animals and there are possible injuries or unexplained injuries that may be through human hands, how that can then link back to owners, for example. So if somebody is listening to this and their ears are pricking up, what is it that you've uncovered so far? Let's unpick some of the meatier stuff. What are the kind of stats, for example, or what are the kind of correlations between people who harm animals and people who then go on to harm humans?
I think I'm just jumping back a tiny bit with this. One of the issues that we have, I think, and all countries do the same way, is that we look at it from perhaps the legislative or our planning method. So we say that different crime types. So we say we have a crime type which could be domestic abuse, and we have a crime type which could be animal abuse.
Yes.
But if you take it back to the perpetrator who commits that, when they're committing an act, they don't think of it as in the same way. They don't think, I'm committing an offence under Section 13 of the Theft Act 1968. Clearly they don't do that. So if you think about how the perpetrator is thinking, then you start to break down some of those artificial barriers that we have within legislation, within strategy. And so for example, if you're a domestic abuser, and you want to abuse, how are you actually going to achieve that? If you want to coercively control somebody, how are you going to do that?
Yes.
So for an example, one of the things that you potentially will do is you'll bring an animal into the household. You will encourage either perhaps a child or your partner, your spouse, whatever, to build a relationship with that, because that then becomes a link which you can then abuse.
Yes.
So if you look at it the other way around, and I suppose, I've been lucky because I've been doing undercover work with sex offenders and pretty nasty individuals.
Yeah.
I kind of try and think how they think and how are they going to do it. So, I mean, the statistics, there are lots of statistics, but I tend to talk about cases because I'm a police officer. I mean, and also I've
the human level, I guess, that's the...
Well, it's a bit of a cliche, really, but I always think that it is a cliche, one victim is too many. And if we can stop one victim, I don't really care whether it's 20% or 80%.
That's a really good point.
We know that 60% of the houses in the country have a pet. We know that one in four women are subject to domestic abuse. One in six men are subject to domestic abuse. Those who have additional difficulties to overcome, so maybe they're elder or they're disabled or they come from migrant backgrounds, they're far more likely to be victims of abuse. But it's still incredibly high numbers, and therefore with the amount of pets that are in the household, and most people see pets as part of the household, in some of them even more than others, and again with gang statistics, 80% of cat owners say it helps them with loneliness. That bond is hugely important. It's important for the survivor, for us as people, but it's also important for the perpetrator, because they know that bond exists. And they're not stupid. They know how to do that. They're calculated. And some of them, horrifically calculated. They've got an end goal, whatever it happens to be, and they'll work towards that, bringing the animal into part of that control.
I'm so glad you brought that in, because that's something that I know it's kind of a heavy, meaty subject today, but this is the thing that I want, because I'm thinking the people listening that may know someone, or maybe even it's the practical stuff as well, can spot signs, ask questions, is that some people will use an animal within the household to restrict someone wanting to leave a relationship where there's domestic violence, where there's children involved. And it's something that sounds really obvious, but I don't think, even just talking to my own friends about some of the work I do in this sector, they're always completely mind blown when I say that people will use that. You know, we've seen cases, haven't we, in the newspaper. You've presented cases, actually, a conference I went to, where people have harmed animals and used that as a means of controlling people within the home. And it's really, it's tricky territory, isn't it, to talk about, but I think it's really important as well. Are you able to talk about some of the ways that people might do that, if you're comfortable?
Well, if I'm going to try and reach, and let's assume that the demographic of 60% is exactly the same that's listening to even this podcast.
Yeah,
60% of people that are listening to this podcast have probably got an animal in the household.
Yes, yeah.
If you think of that relationship that you have with your pet, so again, for simplicity, let's call it a cat or a dog. I mean, it could be a horse, it could be an iguana, it could be anything, but let's say it's a cat or a dog for simplicity. If you think of that relationship, what ways could a perpetrator use that relationship to be able to harm you? So, for example, they could stop you going to the vets. Yeah. That simple one. They could stop you taking that dog out to meet, you know, for a dog walking club that you go to, where you have social interaction with other dog walkers. They could stop you going away on holiday with your friends because they say, you know, you can't go because you've got the dog. Now, but it could be even darker. You know, they could harm the dog, and then you then can't take the dog to the vet because you know that you may well be blamed for that, and you're then going to be seen. Yeah, so that's a double pressure, because they actually harm the animal. They say, you know, because you then can't go to the pet, you then can't go to the vet, and then so there's a kind of double harm that's constantly going on. So that there are a number of different examples, but if you think about it in your own relationship and imagine what a perpetrator could do, that might give you some guidance.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing I think is really important as well, that it's not always physical abuse, you know, very often, you know, something you can see here. It's that psychological abuse, that manipulation. It's the just in case. And some people can end up kind of coerced, can't they? So if you're living with a partner, or let's call them perpetrator, actually, who's continually saying you can't go here or you shouldn't go there. After a little while, we know psychologically that a lot of people can get worn down. So they're also less able to kind of spot it. And you quite often hear that, don't you, with survivors will say when they were in that situation, it's really hard to see what is going on, especially when it's that kind of, I think you use that expression once, that kind of dripping tap, where it's little things that just build up and up, and you get worn down psychologically as well, don't you?
Yeah, but if you are, again, if you look at it from the controller's perspective, they're not going to make it obvious that they're controlling you. You know, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to build that relationship. So if you go, and it could be a bit, you know, obviously careful, because not all relationships are controlling. A lot of them are wonderful relationships, and we have to be, this is a dark subject. But there are also some amazing relationships. But if your relationship is going very, very quickly in the beginning, that should be something that just asks you a few questions, just to say, why is it going that quickly? Is everything okay?
That's a really good point.
I mean, controlling relationships will generally be much faster than others. I mean, again, that's a generalization. So if you're suddenly swept off your feet with, you know, loads of things happening and everything's wonderful, just ask you, is this right? And also, you know, get some advice from outside. You know, talk to your friends while they are still your friends, because obviously a controlling person won't want you to have those relationships.
Yes.
So listen to what your friends and your family, I mean, you know, families don't always like partners, do they? We get that. So you may not get
an accurate. My dog in the background going bananas. Sorry,
it's lovely. I love hearing dogs in the background.
The Amazon guy always comes in a podcast. Sorry,
but listen to what your friends are saying. If they're saying, you know, it's going a bit fast, and just listen to them. You know, just have a breather for a moment, and go. Yes. Okay, is this is this right? And then possibly, you know, if you're slightly concerned, do a Clare's Law request. So actually go to the police and say, this person I'm dating, what have they got a background of domestic abuse? You're not,
that's a really good point.
You're not doubting that individual. You're just a little bit of safeguarding, just to say, and it, if they haven't and you're happy and it's great, then leap forward. I mean, you're not signing a whole prenuptial agreement. All you're doing is just doing a little bit of health and safety. You know, you would do it in most things, wouldn't you? You know, with most things in your life, you'll just, you know, you won't trip over a wire when you're in the garden, will you, when you've got the lawnmower out. You won't.
You know, you do your risk assessment, don't you?
You'll do it. So have a bit of a risk assessment while you're going into a relationship. Do a Clare's Law request. And just think, ask your friends and just say, do you think this is right?
I like that language as well, that, you know, is this right? Because it's the allowing, because I know as a psychologist, sometimes there can be a lot of stigma and shame, or sometimes we can be embarrassed because I'm a big believer in gut instincts. And sometimes we kind of have that kind of visceral urge based, something's not quite right. And that's when a conversation can help. But sometimes kind of stigma, cognitive bias, whatever is showing up. And I love that, because that's really nice language. You know, is this right? What do you think? And as you say, this is what I wanted, real takeaways for people. Friends, that's very different from family. So that's really important. That's really got me, actually, because yes, it is more likely, isn't it, that family members will have a certain opinion. So ask those valued people, trusted people, who are more likely to give you an honest answer.
And if we're going to bring it, this is predominantly about animals, about pets, this conversation.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
if we bring the pets into it, you know, if you've already got pets in your household for whatever reason, see what that relationship is. Now, when I started doing this work, I would probably have said that, you know, the dogs, particularly dogs, are good judges of character.
And
they may well really, really, you know, really not like the partner, or they might like them. But when I first started doing this, I would have thought that, you know, people who don't like, I don't want to be around people who don't like dogs, for example. But actually, if I'm going to exert control over someone, I might actually give too much attention to that dog, because I know that's an important part of your relationship. So if I'm thinking darkly and I want to go, okay, I want to control that person, they love their dog, let me show you how much I love their dog, because they'll accept me more quickly.
Absolutely. Yes.
So just because that person really likes their dog doesn't mean they're not controlling. In fact, they might be more controlling.
Yes.
So think about that. And then if they think that, you know, that as part of it, they want to bring an animal into the family, into the family unit, into the household, again, think about why they might be doing that. What is their motivation behind it? I mean, motivation is always the key, and it always has been within this. If you can understand why people do things, then you've got a chance of being able to, certainly within crime prevention or protection, motivation is always a critical thing. So
that's what we always say in psychology. We always want to know what's the function of behaviour. And if you dig deep enough, you will always be able to find it. It's a bit like, I used to say, it's a bit like paleontology, isn't it? You know, you discover in dying that you just sometimes need to take a little bit of time to uncover more and more. But the big thing for me then that I've learned this morning is that it's just asking the questions, because sometimes we can feel guilt. Gosh, I'm feeling bad because I'm wondering why they want to do this, or I'm wondering why they're behaving this way. And also as well, I know, if you are kind of love bombed, so let's bring that in. Sometimes, you know, you might feel guilty going, but what's wrong with me? Why am I questioning getting all of these wonderful things, or this attention, or these trips, or whatever it is maybe just helping people notice that that's a really normal phenomenon, and it's still okay to push ahead and just keep a little tally of what's happening. And
I mean, if I had an email from someone saying that I'd suddenly become being given £10 million and in a legacy of someone who recently died, I might, you know, something might be triggered in my mind. If something is very, very good, then you've got to question why it is.
Absolutely.
But it doesn't mean that it's wrong at all, but just put that pause in there, that take a breath, and then just look. And, you know, that's exactly what Clare's Law is all about. Take a breath, have a look, and go, now I'm going to make a decision based upon whatever it is.
Which also presumably then impacts your future decision making. You know, if you've had that initial pause, because we know it was interesting, actually, that's a therapeutic model that I use, where the idea is that you kind of pause in the moment, take a breath, helicopter out, observe what's going on, to kind of stop that immediate, right, I've got something happening and I'm responding straight away. We create a bit of daylight. You may know this from my book, between what we're noticing and then how we respond. And I think that's really, is that almost giving people permission to observe and go with their gut instincts and just keep an eye on things. It doesn't mean that you're not a good person, or it's, I don't know what that is. It's almost, I think the word for me is like giving yourself permission. I don't know if you call it that in policing. Is there a term to kind of allow people in a compassionate way to press pause and ask questions and be okay with that?
I mean, one of the first things I ever learned in policing, so this is a long time ago, was that, you know, when there's when you're a beat police officer back in, you know, a long time ago, you never used to run to things because it gave you thinking time. So when you were going to something, the more time you can put in there, then when you arrive at that scene, you will deal with it a lot more efficiently rather than deal with it. You're stressed, you're panicked, you're doing. So just take a few breaths, take that time to come. I had a, you know, I was really unlucky one night at about 3 o'clock in the morning. I was sort of working with someone in a rural location, and we went to a train crash, you know, quite a serious train crash, and actually not far from here. And, you know, horrific, but it gives you that time, you know, charge to it, because it's not going to really make that much difference.
Yes.
What you do need. Just go, okay, right, okay, what are we going to need to do when we get to this train crash? So when you get there, actually, you come across as far more professional anyway, because you've actually thought through, you've got to be the leader in that situation.
So that's something people can apply in situ, because I'm wondering whether actually do, you know, I don't know whether you use the word, but call you, yes, you use the word perpetrators, so let's keep it a bit more loaded, that actually could that signify to someone, is there any research or kind of evidence about people who are beginning to ask questions early on, whether that does influence the behavior of others or the course of a relationship if you are asking those questions? Or
what is it, you know, I mean, I know course. I keep talking about Claire's Law, it's because I'm doing some work on that at the moment around 43 police forces, which is crazy. It's crazy in England and Wales, but anyway, there is very little to say that Claire's Law works, because preventative work around crimes is really difficult to judge. Because you can't, obviously, you can't quantify what you've stopped. And, you know,
it's the same in mental health. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And because I've come from a sort of counterterrorism background, you know, hopefully I've stopped a few acts of terrorism in my lifetime. Yeah. But certainly within domestic abuse, you know, people feel that Claire's Law, professionals feel that Claire's Law works, and because it's a preventative technique, it must have worked. I mean, we still have there's something like 500 homicides in England and Wales every year, and roughly a fifth of those are domestic homicides. That is an area that is worth expanding. Certain homicides is very difficult to stop, but domestic homicides is definitely something you've got a chance to stop if you put the right preventative techniques in place.
I've just realized actually some people may not know what Claire's Law is. You're right to give us a kind of a summary.
Okay, so essentially there are two aspects to Claire's Law. There's right to ask right to know. So the right to ask is that if you're in any kind of relationship, you can apply to the police and say, please, can you tell me whether this person has got any, doesn't have to be a conviction, but is there any intelligence about them being involved in domestic abuse?
Yes.
And the police don't have to reply to that. They can they can look at every single case on its merits. You have to give your justification.
Okay.
But they can give you that information. The other one is where the police actively see that there is a concern. So it could come out of something like multi-agency public protection arrangements or any of the safeguarding issues, and say, we need to pre-warn that person. I mean, at the extreme of that, I used to do something called an Osmond warning quite a lot. And an Osmond warning is where you get credible intelligence that someone's life is under threat. So one of my roles was to then go and tell them that they were likely to be being killed. So, you know, we need to move them. So that was something that I would have done. So Claire's Law is really an extension to that. We don't know that you're going to be killed, but you might be subject to serious harm. And with domestic homicide, again, years ago, an old detective sergeant told me that, you know, every domestic abuse call is a potential homicide. Absolutely. You have to think like that. You know, it couldn't be more important in stopping it. And domestic abuse now, fortunately, is starting to be more understood about being, as you mentioned earlier, about being psychological rather than some old sort of the battered wife syndrome. The
kind of cognitive bias is that it's bruises, battered wife, absolutely, But, and also that it's against women rather than the other way around.
Yeah, I mean, it is... men can be victims of domestic abuse, but statistically and logically, it's far more likely to be women. Again, if you're a bully or a control freak, you are going to target someone who or something, and this is where we bring animals again, who you perceive to be slightly weaker. Bullies don't tend to pick on people bigger than themselves, do they? So, so they would perceive women to be weaker, whether they are or not. That's their perception, and they perceive animals and children to be weaker too. I mean, I think that's actually all a bit messed up. And I mean, you would know more about that than I do. But that's how they, and you've got to think about how they're feeling about it. So they wouldn't target someone they didn't think they could control. And it's the same domestic abuse. It could be in all sorts of gaslighting that goes on now. Is people always target people they think they're weaker? They could be poorer. They could be disabled. They could be more vulnerable. They could be migrants. They could be, you know, people always want to target people they think are weaker.
And it's, again, things like just this podcast, the conversations we have, the meetings that we both go to. It's just that when people are armed with knowledge, you can ask more questions. And because, in my job now, a lot more people are understanding things like coercive control and kind of toxicity in relationships. You may spot that with friends. You know, I've certainly been in situations where I've not liked the way someone's been spoken to and then thought, oh, I'll keep an eye on that. And I've seen it more consistently. And then I've had a conversation that has led to somebody going, actually, yeah, that does happen. Or these other things are also happening. But sometimes we feel, I don't know, it's a British thing as well, whether we can say, even to close friends, you know, we just don't talk about that, or we, you know, historically there's a bit of a kind of keep calm and carry on mentality, isn't there? That's why I love doing things like this, getting these conversations out there and linking it back to animals then, in terms, because one of the things you've been doing is loads and loads of training with the police, haven't you, as well, in terms of what's happening there, because there's a bigger shift now in terms of them keeping an eye on animals in a home and starting to make links then with human abuse, which I think is staggering and can't believe it hasn't been thought of more until more recently.
I mean, I could talk about this for hours. So I'm going to.
Me too. We'll do a whole series on it.
As brief as I possibly can. So when you work with in other countries, which I've done a lot of, they tend to have one police force which is controlled by one political stream. So all you need to do is go and deal with one different police force. With England and Wales, you've got 43. Yes. I know there's some discussions about that changing in the future, but 43 police forces do things 43 different ways. So whenever you do anything, you have to do it 43 times. So it's much, much harder. So some of the things that we try and do, or I've been trying to do, is now if you go to on any police force website in England and Wales, and if you type in animal abuse, domestic abuse in the search bar of that, of your police force, and that will generally come up. If you go into your search engine, and you've got your location set, it will come up for whichever police force you're in. But if you go in any police force, you'll get pretty much the same message now. Right. And we've got, they've managed to put on there what animal abuse within coercive control looks like. So there is some advice in there.
Fantastic.
There is also links on there where you could potentially go to a local charity, and it could be Dogs Trust, Freedom Endeavour, or Refuge for Pets. Could be any of those, and they will tell you where you could possibly get your animal fostered so you can leave the house in safety.
Absolutely, yeah.
Knowing that your animal will be safe while you actually get out of the house, because that's obviously one of the big problems, is a lot of people won't leave because what are they going to do with their, what are they going to do with their three cats and their tortoise? Partly because
which to people is the thing, because that's, I have friends who still, my dogs are my, well, to me, they're kids and dogs. Yep. One is that helping people understand that that is not the silly thing, that these bonds are incredibly important and people will stay if they think their animal isn't able to go somewhere safe, because I think that still gets a bit minimized by people. So,
well, they also, yeah, I mean, there are at least two reasons there. One of which, people won't leave because they believe the animal, they won't leave their animal, they won't leave their children. Yeah. Obviously, they wouldn't leave an elderly parent, they won't leave the animal. In fact, most people would probably are less likely to leave the animal because they're very vulnerable. But anyway, they won't leave the animal. Yeah. But also, if the perpetrator, their partner, has threatened that animal, they know that all the partner needs to do is threaten or harm the animal and they're going to go back. So course they need to take them away. So these services are absolutely critical. But if you go to any police force website, type that in, domestic abuse, animal abuse, that'll give you the information. So that was the first thing that we did. And now the RSPCA have come on board and they've done the same thing. So if you go into the RSPCA website and type that in, you will also get it. So getting information out to potential survivors, potential victims, was one of the first things that we wanted to do.
Which is incredible. Yeah.
That was the first. And then the second thing that we're doing, which is, again, slightly harder, is working with police forces to make sure that their policies understand pets within domestic abuse. And just for example, this month, the Police Complaints Authority have started training their investigators now to understand pets within domestic abuse. So that's happened just this month. But different police forces are setting internal policies now. So that's one of the things that we gradually work through. There is a, when professionals go to a domestic abuse crime scene, and I use this word crime scene a lot because a lot of people understand crime scenes because they watch Netflix. There is the outline of a body laying on the floor. But all crimes have a crime scene, but we tend to only think of the serious homicide ones.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Domestic abuse is a crime scene where there is evidence within that family, and that evidence could apply to the animal as well. Yeah. So it could be, you know, a non-accidental injury to the dog. It could be, where is the last dog? It could be buried in the garden somewhere.
Absolutely. Asking questions.
It's being, a lot of people talk about professionally curious, but it's about, when I've done this abroad, I talk about Sherlock Holmes a lot because he resonates in, across Ukraine, across Greece, across Kosovo.
And
they get Sherlock Holmes because that all the clues are in there somewhere. You've just got to find them. And if those clues are in about the animal, that may well protect the child or the person because that's where the clue is. Don't ignore it. And traditionally, particularly in England and Wales, police officers ignore the dog. They kind of go, well, that's an animal issue. I won't deal with that.
Yeah.
But they don't generally ignore the children. They don't go, well, the NSPCC will deal with that, do they? If there's a child issue, if you go in there, you should be inspecting the child. You know, you should check.
Being curious, absolutely.
Yeah. Just include animals within your domestic abuse crime scene.
Because one thing that might be useful to bring in is that in England and Wales, dogs, pets are still seen as items. They're not seen as having rights yet. And there's a law that's trying to be pushed through, isn't there? But I think that's useful for people to know because I don't think most people know. And I know when I've talked to my friends about this, that, you know, dogs, like if you look at divorce cases or, you know, they're listed as property, not sentient beings with rights, which also then I'm guessing impacts how people will see them within a family home or looking, you know, as you see the children as a human being, therefore be more curious and ask questions. And I'm just wondering whether if there's a shift in the law on that side of things, whether it makes a difference in how people are viewing, you know, more generally the animals that are in our homes and that relationship.
It is gradually changing. I mean, Christina Warner, who's a barrister dealing with Ruby's Law, is looking at trying to get animals within protection orders, which is going to be really important.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you go and search on Ruby's Law, you'll see Christina's work. That's really, really important that's potentially going to happen. Well, I'm sure it will happen. It's just a question of time.
Yeah, I'm going to put all of these things in the show notes, which stay live for people. So anybody listening, all you do on your Spotify, your Apple or whatever, you just click on all of these links or on social media and it will take you straight to all these pages because I don't want to talk about them and then most people don't want to go and type in the search engine. So I've learned now to just put them all because we want people to go and look this stuff up. You know, there may be some people listening to this podcast who now know about Claire's Law and know how to go and find that and know how to look up with their local. So it's the doing bit, isn't it? So the stuff you've shared already has been incredible.
It is. And if you look at why you're doing things, if you look up Holly's Law, Holly Bramley. Okay. So Holly Bramley was, it's a horrible case, but if you do look it up, some of the reporting has not been great on it because it's a bit sensationalised. But look at Holly Bramley. Holly Bramley was murdered by her partner, and I don't tend to talk about partners' names. I like to talk about survivors and victims' names. Because the media tends to go with, you know, oh, this poor perpetrator broke down in tears. Well, I don't really care, to be honest, in the dark. If they've done it, I don't really care if they're crying.
Yeah.
I'm more concerned about the person that's been killed. But anyway, Holly Bramley was killed by a perpetrator, and there were a lot of instances of animal abuse which had they been investigated properly, potentially, you know, and we'll never know this, potentially could have dealt with. Now, Holly Bramley's mum, Annette, is trying to get an animal protection disclosure scheme with another lawyer, Catherine Hayworth.
Right.
And so if you look up Holly's Law, there's petitions on Holly's Law, there's opportunities to contact your MP. And what that would essentially look like is a bit like Claire's Law. So it would be Claire's Law. A lot of people talk about animal abuse registers. This is essentially what it would be. So there's a big drive for that at the moment. And that's a piece of work that I'm trying to look at, you know, what would be the benefit of that?
Yeah.
Because, you know, if within the police protection system, they looked and they saw that there was an animal abuser there who'd been involved in domestic abuse, should they make that disclosure to the, you know, so if the police came along and knocked on your door and said, you're having a relationship with John, you know, did you know that previously he's beaten three dogs to death? You might make a different decision, mightn't you? You might think, not sure I'm going to have a relationship with this person. So that's something that we're trying to do a bit of work up. But if you look at, tragically, you know, Holly Bramley, look at Holly's Law. There's a petition on there to sign that. Talk to your MP about that. I think that'll happen.
Practical things you can do.
Yeah. It's a bit of campaigning needs to get there. But we'll do it.
Well, I was going to touch on that and think so. I like to educate. The whole point of this podcast is I have amazing people on. I learn loads. We have a sprinkle of psychology, so quite often we'll bring in psychological elements. But there's also the, right, you're listening to this and you may have, you know, the hairs on the back of your neck kind of standing up going, oh, I want to get involved. I want to do what? Some little kind of simple things that people may start with that might help in this area.
The first thing, I haven't got this plan, so I'm literally thinking ad lib here.
Putting you on the spot.
But I mean, the first thing is listen and believe people. So if someone comes to you and says something to you about, you know, being a survivor, being a victim, something that's going on, before you do anything else, believe what they're saying.
Yeah.
Because I think historically that's where we've got it wrong, you know, and even within, you know, within safeguarding, we've just not believed enough victims. So, and I mean, that couldn't be more current in the news, to be fair, could it? But let's believe what we're told, first of all, until we find out something is different. So that's the first thing. So if your friend says, you know, I'm worried about, you know, this other friend, I think something's going on, what are you going to do? Not just, oh, I'm sure it'll be fine.
Yes, which is quite an automatic response, I notice, in my field. Yeah, that.
One of the, again, when you start policing, I'm going to go off tangent a little bit. When you're first in policing and you see something that looks a bit suspicious, the worst police officer will go, oh, I'm sure it'll probably be fine. Probably they come up with a defence for themselves. The better police officers will go, doesn't look right, I'm going to go and have a look.
Yes.
And it may be fine. You know, it might be that the fact that they've got a black balaclava on and a stripy shirt and a bag and is absolutely fine. But if you don't go and investigate, you won't know. So
absolutely. That's a good metaphor, actually, you know, because actually I think psychologically, people holding that metaphor to mind of that could be a crime, which could involve victims, human, animal, objects, whatever it is. But that's a good metaphor for that one conversation you may be having or you want to bring up is not minimising, not because you haven't got anything to lose by going, right, what could we do with this?
And, you know, one of the big challenges that we had looking at when we started counterterrorism policy was we talk about, you know, report suspicious behaviour, but how on earth do you know what is suspicious behaviour? Well, trust your judgement. You live in that location. You know what is normal, what isn't normal. If you think it's abnormal, report it.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're, you know, a vet that's seeing injuries, whether it's you're living in the street and the curtains are shut all the time, there's something strange happening there, report it. You know, don't keep it to yourself and justify what's happening and say, oh, well, it's probably because they like having the TV on all day. Like, it's odd, I'm going to tell somebody. Yes. Because then a professional can have a look at it and they go, no, it's fine, you're fine, you haven't wasted my time. But surely if you're going to prevent the homicide, if you're going to prevent someone being a victim of abuse,
absolutely,
just telling somebody has to be the way forward. So that's the first thing. Yeah, if it's any doubt, tell someone about it. Who do you tell? Well, we've just mentioned, obviously, the websites.
Yep.
Crime Stoppers is anonymous. That's always a great thing to go and do.
Yeah.
The domestic abuse hotline, which you could put the number in, would always be good because, you know, there will be told about statistics. I think it's really important that that's there.
Absolutely.
And you'll see the domestic abuse hotline anywhere. If you call them, if you've got any worries at all, you know, there'll be people listening to this podcast who either have been victims of abuse or are going to be victims.
That's exactly it. Yes.
That's absolutely going to happen.
Yeah.
Please go and get some advice on that.
Yeah.
You know, call them, go on police forces, report it to Refuge, report it to Women's Aid, report it to the NSPCC, report it to the RSPCA. Let's bring professionals in, because the professional processes, and you ask what we're doing, and other things, there's a system called the Multi-Agency Risk Assessment Conference, and that pulls together people from across different spectrums of safeguarding, and they discussed high-risk cases of domestic abuse. That information will be fed into those systems, and they'll assess it, and they won't always get it right, but then if they can't do anything if you don't tell them about it.
It's that. It's doing little. Sometimes I think people think it has to be a really big thing. And we know psychologically, sometimes it's the same thing when people say have conversations about mental health, ask how people are. Quite often people don't, because they're not sure if they're going to respond right, or if it's okay to ask. So it kind of sometimes puts us in that fight or flight mode of I'll just kind of move away from it. And what we're trying to do is say to people, there's no wrong way of doing it. Just start those conversations. When you signpost people to any of these places, it's all safe. There's no paper trail for it. You can go report on these websites and use them, and just educate yourselves to that next step. Like you said, I love the fact we kind of come full circle. Just, you said before, just take a pause. Is this right? And you can do that for yourself or someone that you care about as well, can't you? And just arm yourself with information, and that will lead to the next step and the next step, rather than just sitting on things and maybe presuming, because that's something I just wanted to bring in as well, whether some people presume that all of these systems are just automatic and things happen. And they don't. We need to rely on people educating themselves, having conversations, listening to podcasts, asking people questions. That's what's in our control, isn't it?
Yeah, but things are not going to happen unless you take control of them happening. Yeah. And, you know, your friend is not going to be safe from this relationship unless you do something about it.
Yeah.
It doesn't always work. You know, go back to Holly Bramley, you're going to have a long conversation with her mum, and her mum almost could predict what was going to happen beforehand, and she tried everything she could. And despite what you do, things will sometimes go wrong. And it's, you know, it's absolutely not your fault. You've done everything that you can, if you can try and look after, you know, and animals as well. You know, if you're concerned about an animal, report it. I mean, if you want a horrible example, because I'm a ex-police officer, I tend to think about really dark cases. A case in Poland where there was an emaciated dog tied up outside a house. And when the police went along to that, they looked at the dog and thought, I wonder if there's anything else going on in the household. And they uncovered a dungeon underneath, and you can imagine what was in the dungeon.
Gosh.
You know, I'm not going to go into it. And they picked that up from an emaciated dog on the outside, because if you get one thing to look at, look wider. Look at the whole crime scene, as I mentioned earlier. The case in New York where a dog was stabbed by a family member, and the police investigated, but they asked the question, why had that happened? And they identified that the individual that had done it had developed into a very warped form, become a bit of a radical ISIS member, and had built a pressure cooker bomb to blow off in New York City. Really from a dog that had been stabbed, they asked the questions, why, what's behind this, and identified a potential explosion that was going to happen in New York. So it's just from those little things, as you mentioned, ask the questions, because something bigger will come out.
That might be my next question then. So I say my little signature move on this podcast the last 4 years has been, if there was one little adversity takeaway that you could leave us with, one little nugget of wisdom, I know there's many in your vault, what would that be?
A little bit left field, I suppose, with this one, is that it's been quite a dark podcast, and there's a lot of, you know, I've dealt over the years with lots and lots of darkness, some horrible things, some horrific things. But one of the things that gets me through, and I know it gets everybody through, is that bond with their pets that they have.
Yes.
What we're just about to launch, and the time of this could be quite interesting, is the Purple Paw Project.
Yes.
Okay, so the Purple Paw Project is about just highlighting how wonderful that bond is.
Yeah.
Just taking that moment with your dog, your cat, your horse, enjoying that moment and thinking how important it is, how it helps you get through your day, how it makes you, you know, deal with stress, loneliness.
Absolutely.
And just celebrate it and just think, do you know what? This is really nice. There's some pretty horrible stuff out there, but taking the dog for a walk, scratching the cat behind the ear before he decides he doesn't like it anymore. He doesn't like it on a Tuesday and he hits you with it or whatever.
Absolutely. You
know, all these different instances, just enjoy that moment because, you know, that's what makes the world wonderful and the relationship we have with animals wonderful.
It is. If people scroll back in my archive, there's an episode with Dr. Mark Abraham on loneliness and connection and animals. Right. That's one of the earlier ones that I did. And maybe I need to kind of bring a bit more back on that because there's so many physical and emotional health benefits, aren't there? I love that. I will put links to the Purple Paw Project in as well. So where can if people want to kind of find more about you, where do you hang out? Where can people find more about your work?
I think the best way at the moment is to go to Nature Watch Foundation. Yep. So naturewatch.org. Unbelievable charity. I mean, I've worked with a lot of charities over the years. It's a lot of charities achieve a lot of things. Nature Watch achieves a lot of things for not much money for being a small charity. Yep. And that's always the challenge. So have a look at naturewatch.org. Loads of different campaigns on there from Eastern Europe, wildlife, animal testing, companion animals. Work that I'm working on is the Protect Animals, Protect People, which is a slogan that I hope resonates because, you know, if we look after animals, people will be safer too. Absolutely. That's where it comes from. And there's updates on there regularly. So have a look at that one. There's a couple of videos. I've just put a podcast on there about strategy, an act to protect strategy I've just written.
Okay. I'll check that out.
So there's loads of different things to read on that. Yeah, that's it, really.
Fantastic. I'm so pleased to get you on. It's all right to kind of call you my friend and colleague now because you've educated me so much, learned so much. And what a great first episode back after 6 months off. So find Mark, find his work, find those charities. If you're in a position to help any of those charities, please do as well. I always try and get that in there as well. Mark, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I know because your schedule is so busy. So I really, really appreciate the fact that you found time for this. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Tara. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Adversity Psychologist podcast. It's so lovely to have you here. I'm Dr. Tara Quintrarillo, and you can find me at drtara.co.uk. You'll see everything I'm up to, free resources, my media work, and my new COVID recovery clinic as well. Remember to please rate and review my podcast. It really helps people to benefit from the narratives of overcoming adversity if they know where to find us. The Adversity Psychologist podcast, helping you one step at a time.